This is the Politics Lab, a podcast that puts politics under a microscope. On this week's episode, Bill and Phil reflect on Joe Biden's State of the Union speech, discuss startling new evidence that Russia was seriously contemplating using a tactical nuclear weapon in the early stages of the Ukraine war, assess the implications of Laura Trump being announced as the co-chair of the Republican National Committee, and close with the debate over Katie Britt's disastrous State of the Union response speech and how that fits in the long list of bad response speeches. Now let's go to the lab.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Politics Lab. My name is Phil Barker, and I'm a professor of political science at Keene State College. And I'm joined by my colleague and best friend, Dr. Bill Muck, who's professor of political science at North Central College. Happy spring break, Bill.
Hey, thank you, Phil. Yeah, I'm officially on spring break, and I am just 2 days away from seeing you in Florida. This is fantastic.
Yes, I can't. I am not on spring break yet. So you, while you're sitting around in your lounge chair eating bonbons, yeah, I'm still running around doing stuff, working and teaching and all of that. But
sounds rough.
Yeah, 2 days. It's a countdown to Florida. I can't wait.
I'm grading. I've got a paper that just came in before break, and my goal is to try to get them all graded before I hop on that plane, or at least maybe finish them while I'm on the plane. So by the time that plane touches down in Tampa, Florida, all done.
That's good, because I have other tests that are coming in later this week that you can then grade,
sure,
while we're in Florida for me, right?
Absolutely. I don't think there's anything unethical about any of that.
Hey, on another note, what do you think the odds are that we run into Kate Middleton while we're in Florida? Have you been following the news about the princess,
yes,
Catherine, or whatever, Duchess, or whatever her title is now?
A little bit, not super close, but I keep seeing like the news about doctored photos, and now like on Twitter and everywhere, social media, there's all sorts of extra doctored photos of her having fun. Like there was one today of her going down a water slide with like eight arms. You know? So they released a picture to try to calm nerves after her abdominal, yeah, surgery, and then she had doctored it. What's the scoop there?
The royal family announced like months ago that she was having abdominal surgery in January, yeah, and that she wouldn't be like doing anything until like Easter, like the end of March. So all of this was like announced, okay, but like the more time that has gone by without her being seen, like it started feeding into all of these conspiracy theories, yeah, about where is she and what's going on. And then for British Mother's Day yesterday, they released a photo of her. It was the first photo of her since her surgery. Yeah. And it was very quickly afterwards that it was pointed out that it was doctored. Like the AP and all these other groups like killed the photo because it wasn't authentic, which is just fed into more of the sort of various. There's all sorts of, you know, conspiracy theories that they're getting divorced or that she's in a coma or probably the most likely outcome is she had a planned surgery and is recovering, you know,
yeah,
but we like cannot handle that she's not like in front of the cameras all the time. So yeah, I'm expecting to run into her at a spring training baseball game. That's my theory.
Like with a hat on and some big sunglasses. We're used to this sort of stuff with like Kim Jong-un, where he'll go away for a couple months and then, you know, everybody assumes he's dead, and then he shows up someplace with doctored pictures and whatnot. She said that she apologized, right, and said that she had just done some touch-up with the photos, which is also
I hadn't seen that.
I thought I saw some headline where she apologized and said she had just done a little bit of touch-up with the photos. But that also makes me wonder, like, if we post a family photo, I don't usually go in and like do some touch up. And they said there was something weird with their wrists. And it's fishy, Barker. Doesn't smell good.
Yeah. Who knows? Who knows what's going on there? But I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but there's part of me that's like going like it's really easily solved by just having her go step on a balcony and let people, yes, take a couple of pictures of her. So
that's right.
But I also understand that that's a pretty crappy way to have to live your life. Like if I had to go step on my front porch so people could photograph me to prove to everyone that I was still alive, I'd be real grumpy about it.
I think that existence is pretty tough, right? To be in the fishbowl the whole time. And it just lends itself to conspiracy theories and nutty interpretations of things. And I almost feel for them, but you've done this long enough. You got to know you can't post doctored photos because somebody's going to figure that out. Well, all right, we got a lot to get to today. Before we do so, you want to tell everybody how they can stay connected with us?
Yeah, thepoliticslab.com is our webpage. You can go there and click on old episodes, find out about Bill and I, but also on each episode, there are links to articles. We don't have many this week, but there's a couple articles there. We're going to talk about Russia's potential use of nukes, and there's a really interesting article that I have linked about that. And then I got an article from The Atlantic about Katie Britt's response to the State of the Union that's, I think, is also pretty interesting. So there's a couple of articles there you can read if you are wanting to dig a little bit more into our topics.
All right. Well, let's just get into that State of the Union.
All right. So to say that there was a lot riding on Joe Biden's State of the Union speech last Thursday might be the understatement of the political year. Democrats were in a state of panic about the president's age and whether he was up to another campaign. There were widespread calls, as we talked about on the podcast, for an emergency intervention to find anyone to step in for Biden. And those calls took on a fevered pitch following the release of the special counsel report, which stated that Biden was a kind and elderly man with poor memory. Ouch. Yet once again, Biden showed that he was up to the task, giving an energetic and pugnacious speech. We should start by saying that the bar was low, but he leapt over that bar like a spry 70-year-old. Biden didn't mention Trump by name, but he did refer to his predecessor 13 times and made clear the threat he believed Trump poses to the democracy. Biden stated, quote, "Not since President Lincoln and the Civil War have freedom and democracy been under assault here at home as they are today." He attacked the rewriting of the history of January 6th, noting that my predecessor and some of you here seek to bury the truth about January 6th. I will not do that. Here's the simple truth. You can't love your country only when you win. I love that line. That's a great line. His first 10 minutes focused on the threat posed to democracy, the importance of supporting Ukraine and defending the reproductive rights of women. With five members of the Supreme Court right in front of him, Biden spoke of the power of women and criticized the actions of the court in overturning Roe. Bill, this was, I don't know how many people watched this speech. I asked my students 32
million.
Beforehand.
32 million.
I'm skeptical. But still, you know, I talked to my students. I don't think any of them were planning to watch it. But it was a lively speech. You know, what do you make of it? What was the significance? What stood out to you? Where do you want to start with this?
Yeah, normally with these speeches, we focus on what they say, right? So this is a chance for the candidate to lay out the agenda for the next year. And so that's usually what we're looking for. And it's a laundry list of programs to get a sense of the broad philosophy that they're going to bring to the presidency. That wasn't the case this year. It was about the delivery. And it had taken on such importance, right? The narrative was that Joe Biden can't walk anymore. He can't speak, and so the idea that he was going to give this address was going to be devastating. So he had to go out there and directly confront the narrative that he was too old, that the job was too big for him. And I think he did that well, right? I mean, he was, like you said, he was energetic. He went on for over an hour. He was engaging with the audience. I don't think the Biden team could have hoped for a better performance. It was classic Joe Biden. And a couple things that I sort of reminded me of, and then we can maybe get into the substance of the speech. But, you know, Joe Biden's a good politician. He's been around a long time, and he is particularly good in Congress. I think about Barack Obama hated that speech. You know, he always came in and he was grumpy. He got mad when people would yell at him. It felt like an adversarial dynamic. Not with Joe Biden, right? I mean, at one point, you know, he was making fun and joking with Lindsey Graham, and Lindsey Graham is smiling, and you know, he thinks it's great, and he's going back and forth with the Republicans and Marjorie Taylor Greene. So this felt like a very comfortable space for Joe Biden. And I think he, you know, for the moment, he addressed a lot of concerns mostly among Democrats, liberals, and independents that he was up to the job. So in that way, I think he passed with flying colors. I don't think this goes away. This is going to continue to linger with him all the way through the campaign. The next time he stumbles or has something, it's going to continue to be a question. But for the short term, I think he just did a really nice job, and it was a strong speech. Oh, how about you?
No, I think you're right. I watching back, I went back this morning and watched some of the clips of it again. The fact of the matter is this, you know, giving speeches, public speaking, is not Joe Biden's strong suit, right? I mean, that is, like, if you compare the way he delivers a speech to the way Barack Obama delivers a speech, like, you know, Barack Obama is, I don't know, like he's sort of hypnotizing in how he's so good at that sort of stuff. And this is not what Joe Biden does well. And With that in mind, like, I think you're exactly right. He did what he needed to do in this speech, both in terms of like laying out policies, laying out the differences between he and Republicans, laying out in other times, not even the differences between he and Republicans, but the differences between he and many Republicans and Donald Trump. So he, like, on immigration, for instance, you know, he laid out and talked about how he had essentially bipartisan support for this immigration reform bill, and that Trump sort of steps in. And there was, you know, for people who follow politics, you could see, you know, there was the cut to what's his name from Oklahoma, Langford or whatever, who was the senator who was like nodding along to Joe Biden.
That's true.
So those are, I think so. Right. He even said, yeah, that's true. So those things are, you know, I think those are I think he did well. I mean, I think it depends on what you're looking for, right? And for for people who loved Donald Trump and are convinced that Joe Biden is senile, they could look back and there were stumbles and whatever. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, again, he you're right. He's good at the politics part of it. I think if you're, you know, if you are a Democrat or you're, like you said, a sort of moderate Republican who's opposed to Trump, you saw what you needed to see, that Joe Biden's up to the fight. He was lively. He's funny. Like, his ability to sort of, you know, that one, the take, the face he makes when he comes across Marjorie Taylor Greene or whatever.
Yes.
Like, you know, that a lot of that, I think, was really effective. And his ability to, I think more than that, if you're looking for you know, mental clarity or whatever, the number of times he was able to sort of go off script and respond to the way the audience, you know, the way Republicans were booing or Marjorie Taylor Greene yelling at him or whatever, you know, he was able to do that in the moment, which shows you that it's not just reading off a teleprompter. He's actually, you know, thinking about these things in the moment. So, yeah, I mean, I think it was, you know, again, it's clear that they were trying to make him appear energetic, right? The tone that he took, which, you know, Republicans criticized that he was yelling and angry or whatever. But that's what he had to do, right? You can't go out there and give a boring, sleepy speech when everybody's accused you of being a boring, sleepy old man. So, yeah, I think, you know, it's not like an A+, but I think it did what he needed to do.
And I think about, you know, I found it to be entertaining, and maybe some of that was because there was so much buildup about what, you know, how he was going to perform. But, you know, we've watched these over the years and in some ways stopped watching them because they got pretty boring. But this was entertaining, more entertaining, I think, than when you go back and think about some of the George W. Bush or Barack Obama speeches. Yeah. You know, that remark when you're right, when he was going back and forth over the immigration bill with the Republicans, that, you know, that line where he's like, oh, you don't like that. Yeah. I'll be darned. Right. I mean, you know, that show. Biden at what he's good at. And you're right, he's not a great speech. He doesn't deliver a great speech, but I was entertained. And I think that was, you know, for them, that was really, really valuable. And, you know, some like Ezra Klein and others writing for the New York Times have said, it's, you know, the Democrats got to move now, right? You got to get rid of him. This is a critical moment. And Ezra Klein this week was like, I guess we're all right. You know, I guess he's okay. And it also makes me think that people maybe don't appreciate how effective and how good of a president Joe Biden has been. And these are things we can't really assess until history gives some more time. But there's part of me that thinks, you know, his legislative agenda domestically has been very successful with a grumpy Congress. You know, he's been really effective at the foreign policy level. I don't know if people always appreciate how lucky they are to have a president like Joe Biden, because, you know, things can go sideways very, very quickly. And again, you know, history will really give a deeper perspective on that. But there are times I find myself wondering, you know, everybody wants somebody other than Joe Biden. Joe Biden has proven to be pretty good at that job.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, I think. And I think about, like, we've talked in the last couple of months a few times about this, which is about how much of the president, like, in a variety of different ways, we've come at this topic, that the picking a president is so much about image. Yeah. We talked about this last week with the foreign policy stuff, where you have to be strong, even if it's opposed to policies that people want. And I think, like, when the special counsel report came out that described Joe Biden as, you know, old and forgetful or whatever, and we talked about it there too, because there was that really interesting article, and and I wish I could, I don't remember who wrote it now, but a really interesting article about like what we judge a president on. Like, we don't need right. them to do bad math. We need somebody who has good judgment. Right. Yeah. And I think like, that's a good example of where Americans are, they don't like what they see when they look at Joe Biden, but that's a really kind of a crappy way to right. choose a president, right? All indications are that he's still, you know, he's still sharp and he's, you know, able to make these decisions and policies, right? Like even if he's not super sharp, the people he's surrounded himself yes. with, like the policies and it has become so much about, I don't know, like we were so detached from the reality of the economics or, you know, America's global position or any of that stuff that we're voting on. It feels like we've gone back to these, you know, middle school, you know, student council elections.
Yes.
Where it's like a popularity contest. And that's part of the problem with the way we nominate presidents, I think.
That's a really great point. It makes me think about this idea that we now view politics as entertainment, right? And Donald Trump is a lot, you know, that it was going that direction, but he helped amplify that. I mean, he turned politics into WWE, right? You know, wrestling. Yep. And that's the kind of dynamic we want. We want to be entertained. We don't really want good governance. And Joe Biden is somebody who just goes about trying to do the job the right way. And we see that we're not an electorate right now that's willing to reward that type of candidate. We want, you know, even if we dislike Trump, we find him entertaining and that's more what we want. And it's sort of sad when you think about the way in which what it is we look for in a politician. It's not really what we should be doing.
Yeah, and it's a weird, I mean, there's been some element of that. I think back to the Bush, the George W. Bush administration yes. in the elections and the talk about like he was the type of guy you want to have a beer with or whatever. And
yes.
so there yeah. was an element of like likability or groundedness that I get. It's a bad way to choose a president, but I get the appeal of it in some way. He's yeah. relatable. It's like a whole different element of that now, because Donald Trump is not the sort of guy you want to have a beer with. He's not right. down to earth no. or relatable. And yet, so it is, I don't know. It's like he's become this stand-in for it's, I think it's just so much about like anger and, yeah. And fear as opposed to other things. But yeah, it's a weird, it's not a good way to choose leaders.
it isn't. Well, maybe let's spend a couple minutes kind of diving into the substance of the text, especially maybe the beginning part. You know, he came out and he did not, as you noted, he didn't specifically mention Trump's name, but mentioned 13 times my predecessor. And that first part of the speech was all about democracy. I mean, referencing the Civil War, World War II, Lincoln, Reagan. I mean, Reagan got mentioned. I mean, these are these big leaders. And Biden is saying we're at the same type of critical moment. You know, talked about Ukraine. I think he framed the situation, the fight for democracy in the United States, and connected that to Ukraine. Really powerful. It made me think of The Tyranny of the Majority, the book, you know, Levinsky and Zablatt, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Biden was channeling some of those ideas in terms of the importance of democracy and how you have a good democracy, right? That line you read was just brilliant about, you know, you can't like it only when you win. And I thought that was telling that they devoted that much of the speech early on when people, you know, people probably pay attention about 10, 15 minutes and then they flip. And so that's important. What came first, that heavy emphasis on democracy, which I found really appealing.
Yeah, I did too. I think I still think it's the most important issue we're facing right now, right? I mean, everything else comes back around to that. So that's not to downplay all the other issues going on, but like the reasons that women's rights are being attacked or all these other things is because of the sort of perversions to the democratic process that aren't actually, you know, leading to the people's voices being represented. And so, yeah, I mean, this was the opening salvo in the election, you know, fight that's coming. And I think they're smart. I think this is an important issue, obviously, but I also think it's, if we go back to how they won the last time, it is about Biden, but it's really more about Donald Trump. Yes, right. And right. so this is that argument that like, if you want this to be happening again in 4 years, if we're going to have another election, if your rights, you know, whether that's women's rights, whether it's all these other things, like this is, I mean, he touched on those key points, right? The ways in which democracy is being undermined at the ballot box, at the Supreme Court, all of these other ways. And I think that's the message they have to drive home for the next year. And I think if that's what people are thinking about when they walk into the election to the voting booth in a year or in a few months, not way less than a year.
Right.
Yeah. Then Joe Biden wins, right?
And they had an ad that came out basically the next morning, and it was highlighting that, right? So it had Joe Biden, and they started off kind of being funny about his age and connecting that, and then and again, connecting it to democracy. And he's surrounded by smart people. There's a lot of people wringing their hands over whether his team, his campaign team, is up to the challenge. Yeah. And it does seem, you know, if we judge from the speech and then that first wave of ads that rolled out afterwards, it feels like they're in the right place. But I think Democrats will feel a lot better if that continues, especially with the gravity of, like you said, I tend to agree. I think democracy is the most important thing. It's also telling that in those first 10 minutes, he talked about women's rights, reproductive rights. He saw those, you know, so we're talking about democracy, Ukraine, reproductive women's rights. I mean, those are the three pillars that he sort of founded his candidacy on. And that's also really smart.
All of which have the American people are on his side, yes. Right? Those are issues that he wins on, every one of them. So he's not, he doesn't have to convince people. He just has to remind people, right, of the stakes in what we're talking about.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see how they follow all the up from there. But I give the campaign team and Biden himself good credit. Like that he needed to knock it out of the park, and he did that.
I agree.
Well, should we transition to nuclear weapons?
Yeah.
All right. So on Sunday, the New York Times released a deeply reported article by David Sanger, who is one of their guys that really does international work, looking at just how close Russia came to using a nuclear weapon, a tactical nuclear weapon, in the first year of the war in Ukraine. Sanger quotes comments made by Joe Biden at a private event during the time where he said, quote, "For the first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, we have a direct threat of the use of a nuclear weapon," unquote. The Biden administration had intelligence that Russia was contemplating the first wartime use of a nuclear weapon since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Sanger notes, quote, "The intercepts revealed that for the first time since the war in Ukraine had broken out, there were frequent conversations within the Russian military about reaching into the nuclear arsenal. Some were just various forms of chatter," one official said, "but others involved the units that would be responsible for moving or deploying the weapons." The most alarming of the intercepts revealed that one of the most senior Russian military commanders was explicitly discussing the logistics of detonating a weapon on the battlefield, unquote. All right, so apparently Putin was panicked about the prospect of losing Crimea to a Ukrainian counteroffensive. Now, the crisis ultimately passed as Russia gained the upper hand on the battlefield and Ukraine's counteroffensive proved ineffective. Yet it offered a glimpse into a terrifying new era in which nuclear weapons are back at the center of superpower competition. Feels so much to break down here. Not just the prospect of using a tactical nuclear weapon on the battlefield, but also serious discussions about how the United States would respond to that use. So where do you want to start?
Well, I mean, let's start with the possibility of Russia using. I think that, like, how would we respond is a fact. That'll be fun to talk about. But yeah, I mean, I think this is an example of, this will be an interesting sort of test case in lots of ways as we move forward, as people look back about the decisions that were made. But yeah, to realize how close again we came to this. I mean, the way that the reporting lays this out again is that if the counteroffensive had continued to go as it had been going, the odds, I think the article cites like a, you know, would have gotten close to 50, like a 50-50 chance that Russia would have used these tactical nukes. Now, again, this is, there's a difference between tactical and strategic nukes, right? And this is not talking about, you know, what we sort of always think of launching nukes at major U.S. cities or whatever. This is, you know, battlefield usage. It would be a smaller nuclear weapon designed to, you know, target a particular group of Ukrainian troops or something like that. But there's this, again, this taboo about the use of nuclear weapons that has been in place since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so it would have been so significant in that it would have, I think, opened the door, right? Like it would have sort of broken this norm in a way that I think could have potentially sort of altered how countries use nuclear weapons moving forward. I think the thing I think about is, you know, we so often comfort ourselves on the idea that using nuclear weapons is irrational, that no one would ever do it because it would mean their own destruction. And this is another example of the ways in which rationality often falls short in those moments where it seems like everything's on the line, right? And you might think, well, you know, a successful Ukrainian counteroffensive, not everything's on the line, but it's also where you think about we often, as political scientists, talk about what's rational for Russia, and it's not rational for Russia to use nuclear weapons. But If Ukraine had been more successful in pushing back against the borders and potentially taking Ukraine, the threat to Vladimir Putin would have been, you know, it really is an existential threat to Vladimir Putin in a way that he loses control of power, his regime potentially collapses. And so at some point it becomes not necessarily irrational for Vladimir Putin to do that. And it also assumes that we're thinking clearly in these moments, right? Like this is a moment in which Vladimir Putin had been sort of humiliated on the world stage, had been sort of humiliated at home. And the idea that he would think, but it's not, it wouldn't be smart to use nukes. It's just, you know, we just need to remind ourselves of the human element of all of this. It is really startling. I mean, I'm not glad that they were talking about it at all, but if they were, that it was talking about tactical and not strategic weapons. But that really does kind of, you know, provide a slippery slope to other things. I mean, what when you think about this, when you look back on this moment, like, did you have any sense that we were this close? It felt like it there for a few weeks, like we were, the danger was real, but I don't know that I realized just how real it was.
No, I think that's the point, because we knew, like, Biden even said some things publicly like that. We're worried, right, that we're seeing, but we didn't have the specific intelligence, this chatter that was occurring, you know, among Russian military, that they were contemplating this, that they're thinking about this, they're talking about logistical plans of it, and that makes it much more serious. And to your point, I think we too often fall into this sort of position of nuclear weapons are taboo. You have them, so you never have to use them. They're never going to be used, and you know, and that's all fine and dandy until somebody uses one, and then they normalize this weapon. And again, it's important to make the distinction, as you did, between tactical nuclear weapons, a battlefield weapon, and an intercontinental ballistic missile. There's a huge difference there, but one could lead to the other, right? So especially as we think about the escalation of this, once you use a tactical nuke, well, that means it's okay to use them, right? I was thinking about cyber war, right? Once the United States carried out a cyber attack on Iran, right, it legitimizes that weapon to be used by others. So then other people say, okay, well, you can use a tactical nuke, but you still shouldn't use an ICBM. But it's a slippery slope where you start to legitimize that weapon, and that's what's so dangerous. And there's been some really, really interesting things done in the last couple months on nuclear weapons where, you know, some really smart people are saying, like, we have to grapple with this question again, that we are moving to an era where it might become much more likely that states are using these nuclear weapons, and just realize how dangerous that is. That was something we worried about in the Cold War, but since the end of the Cold War, people don't really think about it. And I think Russia has re-engaged us and forced us, because, you know, they're thinking about doing this, right? And if the war shifts back in Ukraine's direction, certainly that is going to be on the table to protect what they see as Russian territory right now. So it's awfully disturbing.
I think that's the part to remember, is that, like, you know, in the intro, you were talking about how the crisis ultimately passed, but we are in many ways still in that moment, right? I mean, both in the sense of Vladimir Putin in his recent sort of State of the Union address talked about not tactical, but strategic nuclear weapons, that if NATO countries basically pushed it too much with Ukraine or committed troops to Ukraine, that he would, he talked about how our missiles can reach their cities, right? I mean, it is, you know, if he's thinking about using it, I don't think it's a pure bluff. And the other part that to come back around to, we've talked a lot about how does this war end? And I think, you know, Ukraine, and people who support Ukraine, understandably, you know, want a war that doesn't end until all Ukrainian territory is recovered. And for some of them, that includes Crimea. But
Zelensky, also, the president, has said that. Yeah.
But what we know now is that if that happens, Vladimir Putin is prepared to use tactical nuclear weapons. And you know, that is a it's sort of the worst kind of blackmail, right? It's like saying if you do that, we will use 100%. Nukes. But it is also the reality of what you're dealing with. And so thinking about how you bring an end to this war that doesn't give in to the Russian blackmail, but also does not push the issue to the use of nuclear weapons, like, that's partly where the thinking about how the U.S. would respond if this happened is important. But it's also important to realize something did happen, right? Yeah. They began considering it, and there needs to be a response to that as well, to try to prevent this from happening should Ukraine start to make advances again.
Because this is such an important point, because all nuclear policy is based on the idea of deterrence, you know, mutually assured destruction. So, you know, throughout the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union build up tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. So the idea that you wouldn't use them, right? So the Soviet Union knew that if they launched an attack at the United States, we had a second strike capability, as did they. So it meant nobody, each side was deterred from doing that. With tactical nuclear weapons, it's not clear how you would try to deter that. So let's say Russia does use tactical nuclear weapons. How does Ukraine, how does the Biden administration respond? They suggested in this article that it was going to be a conventional response, but it would have to be a fairly grave response, right? Do you take out those facilities? I think it has to be something where it escalates and says there's a serious cost to doing this. Now, when you do that, it also increases the chance that Russia will then respond to that, right? So how do you do this without escalating to a more rigorous nuclear exchange, right? I don't know. And it's really hard to think through how do you calculate just the right response that sends a message but doesn't provoke a more irrational behavior from the enemy. It's scary.
Yeah. Yeah, how do you negotiate or how do you reason with someone who is being unreasonable, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's where Putin has this advantage. But yeah, I mean, I think that the idea of, I mean, that one of the, you know, they talked about striking the troops that use the nuclear weapon directly, maybe striking in Russia, that it would be an American or a Western strike, yeah, not a Ukrainian strike. I mean, I think you're right. All of those things make sense. All of those things risk escalation. But I mean, I think back to tit for tat was tit for tat was.
The guy from Michigan. Why can't I think of it right now? Professor of political science at University of Michigan.
The notion, so tit for tat seems like it's always a sort of a silly sounding thing, but this notion in international relations that you basically respond in kind, right? The notion, I mean, to some extent, when you have a normative violation like this, right? When the ban on nuclear weapons is broken, like you can't continue to bind yourself in the same way, right? If you're the only one binding yourself to the rules, you're at this disadvantage. But it's where I think, you know, it requires some sort of escalation. But it's also important, part of sort of tit for tat is the acknowledgement that you're prepared to return to the old, right? It is like, we're going to strike Russia, but that's the extent of it, right? We are not going to do more, assuming you do no more, right? Like this was a response to your use of tactical weapons. And assuming you don't ever use them again, you don't have to worry about this. But, the escalation, the next step is essentially all in your hands. We're prepared to sort of cooperate and move forward, but we're also prepared to do worse if we need to. And so it's really a message of credibility, right? It's like, you're not going to get away with this, but we're also prepared to, you know, to return to the old way of doing things if you are as well. And I think that's important as well, right?
Yeah.
It would be tempting to respond to the use of nuclear weapons with some sort of vengeance. And I think that is, you know, that's a natural human reaction, but it's this ability to say, we're going to punish you, but then, the punishment, you know, what happens next is dependent on your response.
And that's, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about U.S.-Iranian relations, and that is the calculus that the United States has taken in engaging with Iran, right? We're going to send a deterrent here, but we also want to send a message that we don't want this to spiral out of control. And I think Biden is doing the same thing or trying to do the same thing behind the scenes with Russia. But as you mentioned a couple comments ago, right, some of this is dependent upon Putin's logic and his rationality and how he's thinking about this. And he's thinking about this in terms of, as you noted, his own preservation, how he stays in power. And he can't afford to lose territory. So he's got a different calculation as he thinks about using this nuclear weapon. For him, it's about fear. It's about making it clear to Ukrainians that they're not getting this territory back, because if they want to, we're going to continue to use nuclear weapons, right? So it's a different type of rationality, one that may not be persuaded by the conventional tit-for-tat logic, right? That's the, right. I love it. It's sort of the interesting between the state-level interactions and a human being who's thinking about their own role in those interactions as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's Axelrod. It came to me, but Robert Axelrod
right.
is
yes,
the guy
absolutely.
Who did
it. Yes.
I mean, it's one of those where, like, what does that look like? Like, if If Putin's willing to use nukes to maintain his power, then the response that comes from that would have to be endangering to his power in some way. And figuring out what that is not easy, right? Because a direct attack on Russia is just as likely to solidify Russian people behind him. And so how do you in some way send that message? And I think it's important to be sending that message now. If you do this, this will be the price you pay. Yeah. But you have to keep in mind that it's not about a price to Russia. It's about a price to Putin in particular in this instance.
That's right. And one of the interesting things about the U.S. response, so apparently behind the scenes, Biden was reaching out to his most trusted advisor to say, let's have some conversations with Russia to make it clear what those costs will be. But the United States also reached out to China, which I think is really fascinating to say, hey, do you know what's going on here? Because China also, like the United States and China don't agree on a lot of things, but the last thing either of them want is a tactical nuclear weapon. So I would love to know how China responded to that in their behind-the-scenes conversations with Russia. You know, I wonder whether they said, hey, if you use tactical nukes, we can't continue to... who knows? But I think the worst thing they want to see is an escalation, the use of nuclear weapons in that territory.
Well, I think that's brilliant statesmanship, right? That's where you have to let it be shown that you do this and you will be so isolated from the international, like if you think you're isolated now from the international community, right. Like what will come, pales in comparison to what will come as a result. Yeah, it's just hard to wrap your head around the fact that we're having this discussion, not in a theoretical sense, but in response to a real world development. It's terrifying.
And it was in October when this all happened, which was the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? Which had to be percolating in the minds of both U.S. and Russian diplomats. So it was really something. Well, we should probably move on.
All right. So for our next topic, we're going to take a look at recent developments in the Republican Party, and in particular, the Trumpification of that party. On Friday, Donald Trump cemented his control of the Republican National Committee when party members formally voted to install his handpicked candidates, including his daughter-in-law, in top roles at the party. So Laura Trump is now co-chair of the Republican Party. Laura Trump was quick to express her belief that she thinks Republican votes and donors would be happy to see the RNC pay Donald Trump's ballooning legal fees. That's crazy.
Awful.
It is also kind of true, strangely. It only seems reasonable. Donald Trump Jr., the president's son, may have said it best in comments this week when talking about the death of the old Republican Party. So let me play a clip real quick of Don Jr.
I think the RNC is going to be a little bit more of that old school establishment that Republican Party, frankly, no longer exists outside of the D.C. Beltway. But, it takes a little while to make that transition. But again, I think, the moves that happened today, I think that's the final blow. People have to understand that America First, the MAGA movement, is the new Republican Party. That is conservatism today.
I think that is so, I mean, it's crazy to hear him say that, but I think he's actually right.
Yes.
So, yeah. Along those lines, on Saturday, the Oklahoma County Republicans censured their very own Republican Senator James Lankford over his work to advance a bipartisan immigration bill. We talked about that in the State of the Union. This was the bill that had bipartisan support until Trump decided it was bad for his reelection and had the party kill it. And let's not forget, this week, Trump welcomed Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban to Mar-a-Lago for a chat, after which Orban said that if Trump is elected president, quote, he will not give a penny in the Ukraine-Russian war. That is why the war will end. Bill, this is all happening very fast. There's no reason to be worried about any of this, right? This is all very normal stuff in the world of politics.
It's so not normal, Phil, right? The thing is, we've seen this. This is where political science is valuable. Like, people who study authoritarian movements and democratic decline, democratic retrenchment, we see this all the time. Former democracies who move in an illiberal direction, you have some sort of authoritarian takeover, and they don't want to remove all the elements of democracy because they want to retain those elements. Think Hungary, think Russia with Vladimir Putin. You maintain the democratic institutions, you just jam all of your people in there. So it's not really a liberal democracy. It's an authoritarian system that, feeds the political ends that you want. And this is what we're seeing. And they're saying the quiet part out loud, right? When Don Jr. says, like, yes, this is no longer the old Republican Party, this is the MAGA movement. What he should have said is, this is the Trump movement, right? This is 100%. The Trump party right now. It's no longer the Republican Party. It's the Trump party. and how audacious to put your daughter-in-law in charge as a co-chair of the RNC. Of all the things that upset me, and the Orban stuff really upset me, the fact that he was so transparent to say, I'm putting a family member basically in charge of the party is so blatant. It's so egregious. It is what happens when authoritarian figures are doing this and taking control of a system. Now, at least it's only a political party and it's not the government, but this is what's, if Trump wins, this is what comes next. Trump loyalists get put in all these positions of power to defend the interest of one Donald J. Trump. And that's it, right? And I think that's why the immigration bill is so interesting, because this was a bipartisan piece of legislation where basically Biden caved to what the Republicans wanted. And then Trump decided this isn't what he wants right now because it's not good for his election. So he kills it. I mean, it is not about, this is no longer a party about ideology or ideals or anything. It is entirely about Donald Trump and the crime family that he is now using to run it. I can't, some of these things when I watch them, I can't believe that they're actually happening. So I'm really worried about this, Phil. Talk about the alleged. Should I be this worried?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I mean, you should. Yeah. I mean, this is you're exactly right. That I think all the stuff you were saying about there's, we talked last week about how there's not a, you know, last time there wasn't a
platform. Yeah.
A party platform. And yeah, it's because it's whatever Donald Trump, you know, decides to be. It has become, like you said, it's no longer about ideology. It's no longer about values or principles. It's about a person. It's a cult of personality surrounding this one person. Whatever Donald Trump wants is what goes. And you know, others are, we talk, and like I think about all these political science ideas of like co-optation, right?
Where
the same thing, like you co-opt people. All these offices still exist, but they are all in some way indebted to you or whatever. The concept that, and this is, I wasn't thinking about this until you started, you know, doing the intro. I used to teach African politics, and we spent some time talking about the big men of African politics. So from the 60s through like the 90s, there were all of these sort of African dictators. And the concept, the term that was used to talk about them all the time was this idea of personal rule or neo-patrimonialism. So this is, you know, it's a very political science term, but the idea was, like, if you looked back at, you know, monarchs, right, the monarchs, there was like no separation. If you think about European monarchies, there was no separation between like the person and the office, right? They were in power because of their position in society. They were the law. They weren't, there was no law, rule of law. Rule of law was, you know, it was whatever the person said. They, you know, the king could get up in the morning and decree something to be, and that's the law, that's the rule. The country was essentially their personal property. Like, there's just no divide between the person and the office. And there was an element of that with all of these dictators in Africa in the second half of the 20th century. But the difference was that the thing that they were called, the reason it was called neo-patrimonialism, was what political scientists talked about, the facade of institutions, right? They pretended to have elections. They, you know, they had a military, but everybody in positions of power was there because they were loyal to the president, right? They wanted to be, you know, if you wanted to maintain your position in, you know, access to power and money and all of that other stuff, you had to be loyal. And the instant you were not loyal, you were out and somebody else was in. And it is like, used to teach that, it was, you know, it seemed this kind of far off thing. And it is very much where the Republican Party is now, right? It's this idea that Donald Trump rules by decree, whatever, he can get up tomorrow and say something different than today. And it's, everyone will just pretend that it hadn't changed, right? They're just on board with the new notion. The failure to separate him from, like, again, that essentially government belongs to him, right? That the country, that, you know, when he's in office, there's no real divide between official finances and his finances, the party finances and his finances. This idea of loyalty is all that matters. Like, all those elements are there. And it just terrifies me if we elect him and put him in office. You know, our institutions in the U.S. are still in place and could protect us to some extent, but I don't know. And I think they did protect us in his first presidency. But, you know, when you reelect that person, the institutions can only hold up so long, particularly when everybody in his party is on board with that approach.
Well, and especially given the sort of philosophy he's been advocating, which is attacking the deep state, right? That the deep state is this terrible thing. And so he now realizes what he is doing to the Republican Party, he is going to do to to the U.S. government. You need to get rid of all those bureaucrats, those technocrats, those people who are governing and doing what they think are the right, you know, and you replace them with loyalists. So they're talking about thousands and thousands of positions that are, you know, bureaucratic positions where people stay in those positions, whether or not a Democrat or Republican is in office, shifting all of that so that these are all loyalist. And again, you're absolutely right. It creates a cult of personality where it's all about the great leader, the great man, and nothing about governing. And I mean, it's, as you were talking, it made me think about the transition we've seen in China. Because China's been an authoritarian system for a long, long time, but it was an authoritarian system dictated by the party. So presidents were allowed to serve two terms, and then they moved on. And President Xi has now done a third term. And what we've witnessed in China is a transition from authoritarian system based on the party to an authoritarian system based on a person. And I think there's a similar dynamic in the United States that Donald Trump likes that. He likes that structure. It's so terrifying that we're having these conversations about Joe Biden being too old when we've got another candidate who is openly engaging in tactics that we know to just be authoritarian in nature. It's not like we don't know these things. It's not like we're guessing. You know, Don Jr. is saying them out loud. You know, Trump is having Viktor Orban to Mar-a-Lago. That's such bad optics. But the reason he's doing that is he wants to normalize authoritarianism. He wants to make these things normal. And so it's a very calculated strategy, but oof, it's bad, Phil. It's really, really bad.
I mean, the appointment of the thing we started with on this is the appointment of Laura Trump, which is like in and of itself, right? If you just step back from it and look at that, like, I think you're exactly right. All of this is like all sorts of red flags, but just the notion of, you know, if decided that, hey, you know, there's a job at Keene State and I think my wife should get the job, that right. There would be all sorts of like conflict of interest. That's a bad idea. We need other people involved to look into this. And here he's not even the nominee yet, right? Like he's just and he is putting before we even get to the actual official nominating process, he's putting family members in charge of the party. Like it is really, it's not surprising based on the direction of the Republican Party for the last 8 years, but it is shocking in the abstract. Like when you step back and look at it and think about corruption and what it symbolizes, the idea of the control of sort of one man over this party is remarkable.
And then where do you go after Trump, right? When you create, the example of sort of those African great men's examples is fantastic because they didn't know where to go after. Once that leader dies, there's no clear who takes over next. And oftentimes they stay in power until, well into their 90s because there's no way, there's no good retirement plan for an authoritarian. So they stay in power. So what happens after Trump, right? Does he'll stay in for power as long as he can, but then it goes to a family member. So we're looking at Don Jr. or Laura Trump or Ivanka as the next, you know, leader, right? That's the only way this continues because you can't go back to normal politics. You can't have a real primary because you've now put people in these positions that are going to make sure that doesn't happen. It's just stunning. It's just stunning that this is happening, Phil. I'm really shocked. And I would think, I'm sure there are a lot of Republicans who are troubled by this as well. Those who aren't, you know, firmly behind the MAGA train.
Yeah, I mean, it really is that you're talking about what comes next is, I mean, it really does shed some light on the way in which, like, the last 4 years, people have tried to, their path to trying to be president or earn the nomination isn't a path of laying out policy arguments, right? It's the reason why Ron DeSantis is trying to be Donald Trump, right? It is a weird thing. And when Donald Trump's gone, like what are the principles that are left other than we're trying to find someone who sounds like Donald Trump, which can't be done, right? There's just not going to be another Donald Trump. There might be other iterations of populists or, you know, sort of neo-authoritarians or whatever, but they won't be Donald Trump. I think the part I just come back around to is that, you know, we've watched for now almost a decade as stuff that happens in other places around the world and that we look at and talk about, as problems in democracy, how democracies break down, authoritarian stuff that we just take for granted won't happen here. We've just watched it, you know, time after time come back around to this is the way things are playing out at home.
It's just stunning. And again, we can't even really have a reasonable conversation about this because we got to focus on Joe Biden and his age, right? You know, it's just All right. Well, should we transition to our final topic?
Yeah, it's kind of a good point. The control of Donald Trump over the party sort of makes sense as we turn to Katie Britt. Go ahead.
This is right. Okay, so for our final topic, we're gonna return to the State of the Union, specifically to the Republican response. So it's likely that our listeners know that following the State of the Union speech, the other political party gives a rebuttal, and the responses are covered by all the networks and is seen as an important opportunity to respond to the president's remarks. It is also notorious for being a career killer for up-and-coming politicians. There's a long line of awful State of the Union responses, and our listeners should just go and like Google and kind of watch some of these. For instance, in 2009, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal gave a speech where he sounded like Mr. Rogers. It was really weird. And that was kind of the end of Bobby Jindal. In 2013, Senator Marco Rubio got a serious case of dry mouth during his remarks, where he was forced to awkwardly gulp water from a tiny water bottle while he continued to maintain eye contact with the camera. It was so weird. And then 2018, Democratic House Representative Joe Kennedy gave the speech. He had chapstick smeared all over his mouth and chin, giving the impression that he was drooling. It was just, again, all of these are worth watching. But then came Katie Britt, and it's useful to play a bit of audio from her. I'm sure our listeners have heard, but we got to go there. Phil, why don't you play a little bit of the clip?
All right.
President Biden's border policies are a disgrace. This crisis is despicable. And the truth is, it is almost entirely preventable. The American people are scraping by while President Biden proudly proclaims that Bidenomics is working. Goodness, y'all, bless his heart, we know better. There's no doubt we're at a crossroads, and it doesn't have to be this way. We all feel it. But here's the good news. We, the people, are still in the driver's seat.
Phil, this is really weird. I don't know what to make of it. I as I was watching this live, I'm going, because you normally you tune in just for a second to sort of see what's going on, and then I couldn't turn away. Like, this was, you know, it was like a car crash or something where you don't want to watch, but you do. What are we to make of this? This is really something. So what were your thoughts?
I understand what they're going for here. Yeah. I mean, I could see where somebody sat down and said, we need, you know, a woman talking about, you know, issues facing families and the idea of like that it's, I mean, the playbook of the Republican Party is sort of a fear-based playbook. Yeah. And so that was very much it. But it was this bizarre contrast between like her demeanor and the topics she was talking about. And then the substance was bizarre. I mean, she's been pointed, like a number of things that she talked about have been pointed out as either inaccurate or misleading or whatever since then. But I mean, it comes down to the style, right? There's no doubt. Just yes. And it feels like she's about to cry at times, and it's so it's breathy. It was all just so strange. The thing I think about is the delivery, the style of delivery more than anything else is probably a surefire sign that it missed its mark, right? Like, I'm not talking about the substance. We're talking about the person and the delivery. I don't know. I mean, what other than it's so strange, like I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is like, she really is a rising star in the Republican Party. And if you hear
was
right, that's true. This may be a moment. This is a Bobby Jindal moment. If you hear her speak in other contexts, she's thoughtful, smart. I mean, I don't agree with her ideology, but she comes across as a really good politician. The delivery is so weird. So a couple of things. One, the delivery is strange, right? This, the play up the idea of fear, and you're right, almost on the verge of tears, and all of that was bizarre. Like, how they thought that was the right approach. But also the kitchen. The kitchen was really weird, yeah. Right? You know, this idea that, well, if it's a woman giving this, we should think about putting her in the kitchen. It makes me think that Republicans don't know how to handle women. They don't know how to think about how do we appeal to women? You know, how do we know that the women don't like Donald Trump. What do we do to get them to like Trump? Put a woman in the kitchen, right? I mean, it just feels desperate and weird. And it wasn't even her kitchen. Like, I guess it was some random kitchen that they put stuff in. Like, she's got a
But she said she and her husband pray at that kitchen every night, Bill. At that table.
Well, as you noted, she wasn't very honest throughout this, right? That whole story that she told about meeting this woman and implying that, you know, she had suffered because of this happening during Biden. And it turns out it happened out of the story was from
during the Bush administration.
Right. Yeah. All of that backfired. I mean, this is exactly what you don't want to happen, right? You don't want to be explaining why you gave a bizarro speech with all sorts of, you know, factual inaccuracies. It's just, this was a dumpster fire. For most, I think, voters who are paying attention, not all, some.
Yeah. Well, so I'll play devil's advocate a little bit, because I 100% agree. It was odd to watch. It felt like, you know, Saturday Night Live did an instant cover of it, because it felt like a Saturday Night Live skit, the way that she was delivering the overly dramatic reading of things. But I kind of think that this is like, you know, we were not the target audience, right? Like, we're not the target audience. And I wonder if this doesn't play pretty well. I mean, the stuff that she talks about, it is all stuff that, you know, that Trump voters are here, Fox News viewers are hearing about the economy, about immigration, about and it is the playbook of the Republican Party, which is fear, right? Like, it is, she talks about, I think about my children, and she's citing people who have been attacked by, you know, by immigrants and by, you know, the difficulty. And I wonder if, you know, it again, like, there are a significant chunk of conservative women who I think probably connected to that in some way. So if you're trying to, again, if you're not trying to win people over, but you're trying to shore up your, I mean, it's again, the Joe Biden comes out in the first 10 minutes talking about women's rights, and this is sort of the response. And I don't know. I mean, I think maybe a slightly different tone to it would have been more effective, but I also kind of wonder if it hit home more than we realize.
This is a great point. And I wonder about that too, right? I wonder, can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I wonder if that was the case. I can't hear myself. So I think I clicked the wrong button, Phil. I wonder, you know, what'll happen over the next couple of weeks as we sort of see the fallout from this. Like, does it continue to be a pariah, or is she brought back in? Is she, you know, does the Republican Party put her away for a while, or, you know, does that resonate? I know there was some initial pushback from a lot of Republicans who thought this was a dead disaster, but that's different from how people who are consuming this in right-wing circles, how they react to all of it. So I think that's a really, really important question.
Donald Trump came out immediately afterwards and praised her for her delivery or whatever, right? And so if it is the party of Trump and people are looking to him for the signals they get, then yeah, I don't, I think we do live in sort of two separate worlds. It's one of our problems in this country right now. But it doesn't feel like there's any attempt. Maybe that's the difference, is that I think that in the past, the response, both the State of the Union and the response, there was an attempt to sort of speak to the country. And it feels like this is not an attempt to speak to the country. This is an attempt to speak to, you know, your base, right? And so the messaging is different. And there's, I think, part of the reason why it sort of hit so badly with such a chunk of the country is that there wasn't an attempt to, they're not trying to pick up swing voters. They're speaking to their base.
Yeah, no, 100%. And, So now the thing is, you also wonder, how does the Saturday Night Live play out as well, right? Do people see that and feel that they feel embarrassed, or does that reinforce the "see it's us versus them"? And again, I think you note this correctly. It could play one of two ways. It could be that people feel like that was a bad choice on her part, or see it's those liberal elites in the big cities who don't get us and they mock us. It can reinforce that divide as well. So it's curious.
I sort of suspect that either way, this was bad for Katie Britt.
Yes,
I think it might have been good for Donald Trump. I think the message, even if it hits with the base, might help Donald Trump. But I feel like this was such almost kind of a, I don't know, it was like, sort of this like weird stereotype or whatever. Like it was such a kind of over the top version of you know, a conservative woman or whatever, that I wonder if it's hard for her to shake that. Like, you know, in any sense, like she will be stuck with this kind of first impression of that the country had of her for a long time. I mean, I think about all the others, right? Like you talk about Bobby Jindal sort of being done, and that Marco Rubio one. I remembered him being dry, like having dry mouth, but I went back and rewatched it after this, and I had forgotten just how bad it was. I mean, I think this is, for somebody who did, I think, have a lot of future and promise, and it seemed like could navigate the halls of Congress pretty well without sort of being, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene. It feels like this was not a good thing for her.
Well, you know, to connect to our previous topic, you know, the audience that may matter most is how Donald Trump responds to this. What does he think about it? Does he think, you know, I haven't heard anything, but does he think she did a great job? Did he embarrass her? And that might dictate her future, right? Does Donald Trump, how does he feel about her? And if he likes it and thinks she does a good job, she'll be welcome back. If he felt it was embarrassing and she didn't do a good job of it, that's it. You know, she can continue to run for Senate, but he'll endorse somebody else, right? That it all comes back to Donald Trump. So,
man.
Yeah, well, it's probably a good point to wrap up. Phil, tell them how they can stay connected with us.
Yeah, you can find us at thepoliticslab.com, and you can find old episodes there. And this one, again, there's an interesting piece in The Atlantic on Katie Britt. And then if you wanted to get more information on just how close we were to Russia using nuclear weapons, that article is also linked there. Those are both at thepoliticslab.com.
All right, Phil, I will see you in exactly 2 days, 2 hours, 47 minutes, and 33 seconds.
I can't wait. And then we'll be back the week after to our normal Wednesday sessions after that, all refreshed and tanned, too.
Absolutely. All right, I'll see you in a few days, Phil.
Bye, Bill.
Bye, Phil.